Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rates and Lanes with your hosts, Rico Muhammad and Chuck Snow.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Rates and Lanes podcast. I'm your host, Rico Muhammad. Be joined here in a few seconds by my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow. Looking forward to tonight's show. We got our resident experts, Mr. Hank Seaton, our resident legal expert, and then we also have our resident insurance expert with us as well, Mr. Tommy Rook. So it's always an exciting evening when we have these gentlemen on board. I always learn a tremendous amount from them both, and so I'm looking forward to tonight's discussion. With that being said, let's jump into this week's Trend Lines report. And as I stated last week, we are on a creeping incremental upcline in the price of diesel fuel. Diesel fuel is starting to tick up every weekend, and we're starting to see these prices starting to really just start going up and up and up. So something I want you guys to be cognizant of. So from last week, we're up by 2%. The national average price of diesel fuel is up to $3.48 per gallon now. Reefer markets heat up as temperatures cool. So from the period of last week, the first strong snowstorms of the season in the Rockies hasn't been enough to dampen demand for temperature-controlled equipment. Reefer spot rates ended last week at an all-time high of $3.22 per mile, inclusive of fuel. That's more than a dollar per mile higher for the first week of October compared to the average of the last 10 years. So that's, and as we stated, you know, we're in uncertain times. And so I think we're going to start to see some new averages and new highs. And hopefully, you know, we can stay away from the lows. But, you know, with the highs come lows. So let's jump into the report, see how dry vans were performing over the previous week. Starting out up there in that northeast corner corridor, showing that the outbound spot market average coming out of the northeast is at $2.63 per mile. Moving down to the mid-Atlantic, we're showing that the average outbound spot market is $2.73 per mile. And coming out of the Midwest, we're showing that the average outbound spot market rate is $3.07. Moving down to the South Central region, we're showing that the average outbound spot market rate for dry vans is at $2.57. Coming out of the West Coast, wrapping it up, showing the average outbound spot market rate at $3.01. Shifting over to the flatbed report. Over the previous week, starting out in that northeastern corridor, we're showing that the average outbound spot market rate checks in at $2.91 coming out of that northeast. Moving down to the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states, we're showing that the average outbound spot market rate is $3.24 for flatbeds. Moving up into the Midwest, we're showing the average outbound spot market rate at $3.29. Coming out of the South Central region, we're showing the average outbound rate at $3.01. And coming out of the West Coast, we're showing that the average outbound spot market rate checks in at $2.77. Checking in on the temperature control portion of the report, coming out of the Northeast, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate of $2.94. Down in the Mid-Atlantic and Southeast, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate of $2.81. Going up into the Midwest, we're showing that the average outbound spot market rate for reefers at $3.61. Coming out of the South Central region, we're showing the average outbound spot market rate at $2.96. And wrapping up, coming out of the West Coast, we're showing that the average outbound spot market rate is at $3.44. And with that being said, let me go and grab my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow. Good evening, Chuck. How are you?
We're doing great. How are you, Rico?
I really cannot complain. Trying to navigate through some of the changes that are coming down the pike. It's been kind of good on my end as far as business is concerned. But I'm always trying to take a look and see what might be coming down the pipe. I'm kind of worried about what is it that I don't see. It's always the punch that you don't see that knocks you out.
Well, of course. I really do think, unless something weird happens, I think that there should be blue skies yonder for the next year anyways. And the big reason for that is I don't know where we would get enough drivers to bring into the industry that would, make any changes. That's the only thing that's going to happen. Inflation is coming. It's here already. That may have an effect on some things, but, there are so many, this was explained to me yesterday, because of COVID and how we've changed. Before COVID, for the most part, when any of us needed something, we would go to, you needed a shirt, you went to Walmart, or you went to the mall and you bought your shirt. And really, it was a mini warehouse wherever you went, even if it was a small store. Now, all of a sudden, you have these million square foot Amazon facilities and all sorts of email order houses, and they have to be staffed. And you have staff that are putting away merchandise and other staff taking inventory out for orders. And then you have the people sorting it and all these other people. These are all new jobs. And people have left other industries, such as the hospitality industry, to take these jobs because they're paying better. And I think because of that, there is going to continue to be this shortage of labor in the trucking industry unless we can pay a whole lot more money. And I don't know if we will. So, I think for the next year to 2 years, it's clear sailing unless – some catastrophe happens somewhere, and that could happen anytime. You never know. But that's my take on it, talking to a lot of people, and getting different takes. I was talking to somebody the other night. Now, our minimum wage up here in Ontario is $15 an hour, and you need every bit of it because you got to remember, in Toronto, a tiny, tiny, tiny little house in the worst of districts is $1 million. So $15 an hour doesn't get you far. And somebody was telling me there was an ad in the newspaper or online or something for help in a roadhouse at $12 an hour because they can get away with – there's a restaurant minimum wage, which is under the standard minimum wage because of the tips. And, of course, nobody's taking those jobs. So that's the big difference. And I think that will keep – just the way things have changed – and people are buying so much material online, which has been really good for the trucking industry. I just think, I think it should be pretty good for the next year to 2 years anyways. That's my take.
Well, I'll tell you what, we've got some experts on with us tonight. I got a couple of questions I want to bounce off of Tommy.
Yeah, I got one too.
I'm coming up on... I'm coming up on renewal time, so instead of just having a conversation between you and me, let's go ahead and welcome Tommy and Hank onto the show. Good evening, gentlemen. We're glad that you guys have took a little time out of your schedules to come and be back with us here on the Rates and Lane podcast. How are you guys doing this evening?
We're doing fine. Listen, I usually spar with Tommy, but tonight I'd like to. Spar with my friend Chuck a little bit.
He says he sees
good times ahead. He says he sees good times ahead in trucking. I'm just working on a presentation to be made to our Department of Transportation on why we have such a supply chain shortage and what government intervention can they propose to solve the driver crisis. So I've got a decidedly pessimistic view of the future that I'd be happy to talk about. I think that
We'd
inflation is here. I think inflation is here. I think that our current administration is making it impossible for entrepreneurship. I think that AB5 and the imminent demise of the independent contractor standard is going to suck the life out of a lot of small carrier and small entrepreneurship that is feeding the trucking industry. I believe that the 100,000 newbies trying to find authority from the FMCSA demonstrates that the truck driving shortage is going to be exacerbated by AB5 and the fact that folks have traditionally partnered with responsible carriers to run their own business. And I think a large number of people are not going to succeed as newbies because of the insurance crisis that we're talking about. So I think it's a dead end for probably as many as 100,000 truck drivers. And I think that the ones that will be leaving the industry are the pearl of great price. They should be encouraged to stay. But I don't think that our current administration down here understands trucking. Their solution to the problem, the one that they're aching for people to comment on, is all we need is a good Teamsters union. And for those of us who have lived through the Jimmy Hoffa era, we'll tell you that if you want a bottleneck, get a strike or a slowdown or a lockout. And you know, I think this idea of taking the one entrepreneurial bright spot in the whole industry, trucking, which can't be exported to China, and futzing it up with more big business is it certainly hits close to my home. And to say that it's going to be a brave new world is not going to be a good thing. So that's my story, Chuck, and I'm sticking to it.
You know what? I do agree that there is, you know, some of this legislation doesn't make any sense. But I got to tell you, and no offense, I know I'm the lonely Canadian of the four of us, but I haven't seen a real trucking friendly administration in decades, including the last one. They didn't do anything. When's the last time that we had an administration, or you had an administration in the United States that was really trucking friendly? Ronald Reagan, I guess.
Eisenhower, when he built the interstate system, is the last one I can point you to.
Yeah,
and I remember Eisenhower. I remember Eisenhower.
Well, I vaguely remember him. I think I was about Kennedy took over from him, correct? If I'm not mistaken.
Why do you say Chuck?
Kennedy
took over. Yeah.
Kennedy was in the 60s. Wasn't there somebody between Eisenhower and him? Tricky Dick, I guess, tried to run and didn't win.
No. Because, you know what? Eisenhower was 60 years ago. More than that, 65 years ago. That's a lot of friendly discussion.
I was in middle school.
All right.
I remember I liked Ike.
I would slightly, I don't disagree, but I slightly would walk the middle ground here. I've even seen, and Chuck, you're sitting in this thing, and Rocco, you're there, that some of the trucking companies are actually precipitating the driver shortage. They don't want the capacity to increase because that's the rate. When you talk about the rate at a 350 or 320 for refrigerated goods, That's $100,000 more revenue per year. Obviously, they got to haul the loads to do that than they did a year ago, or the average, I mean. That's a lot of money involved in this stuff. And, Hank, I understand, and I'm a firm believer of the independent contract agreement, but the California case that precipitated this happened before your present administration was in office. And it's, I'm not saying the administration's had anything to do with any of it.
Hey,
obviously,
hey,
listen. Whoa. I'll let you talk.
All right, go ahead, man. You got to say.
Obviously, it came out of California to start with. My recommendation always has been if you had to build a wall, build it on the east side of California. I take everything out there. That's where it needs to be done. And the second thing is, actually, the Massachusetts case that started this, the Supreme Court turned down, they're looking at it here, was from a long time ago. I don't know if Romney was governor when that happened up there or not. But anyway, I don't know what's going to come around of it. It's going to happen away. I'm also very concerned about the owner-operators here. You talk about 100,000 new ones this year. Hank, I don't know, with the money flowing like it is and the spot market as high as Rocco just went through, I think they'll survive for a while. I do believe that the insurance cost has receded some. It's not going down, but it's not accelerating at the rate that it used to be. It's more available. There are 3 or 4 more markets in it. But every market that we're dealing with is being extremely selective. And we're going to change the whole model of insurance. And I've preached this the last 3 or 4 times here. Everybody's listening to us. You need to be prepared to share your electronic data information with your insurance carrier and prove, just like you do these new car commercials to save money, and prove that you are operating not only not getting stopped by the FMCSA and inspections and having CSA scores, but going on where you're going, and the miles you run, and then also prove that you're operating safe. This is where it's going to go, because it's natural. It's there because the data's there. And that's something new, and the insurance companies are aware of. It's just a matter of now figuring out how to properly use it. And this is what the insurance companies looking at to do now with it. And this is where it's going to go. I just worry about the business plan. And these people put enough money away because these rates can't hold forever. But with that said, I do agree with Chuck that the economy's good and the times are good. And there'll be a way to deal with what we're facing with. That's the big part of it. The trucking industry is going to adjust. We've adjusted many times. I do agree that it would hurt the industry to lose it on our operators, and I think that's not going to happen overall. But again, that's where we are. That's my opinion, okay? And that's my insurance part of it.
Well, speaking of insurance,
Tommy, I guess if you're finished for a while, I'll suggest that, in terms of searching for an insurance solution, the fact that well over 50% of these 100,000 new people have only one market to turn to, probably suggest that the market says show me the money, and there isn't enough money in writing one truck Charlie when you can write some guy who's got 100 trucks and 100 times the premium. I've heard you preach, and I understand that the market feels as though it has to have some metric other than licensed, authorized, and insured in order to underwrite a newbie. I wonder sometimes if RICO's over-the-road record shouldn't be a good indication of the kind of company he operates, and if the added telemetrics is somebody who's really going to look at it for two truck Charlie. One of the things that I think that is dangerous is to say, well, we'll put a few bells and whistles on this for a big carrier, which pays nothing really to put it on new equipment. But if you're a small carrier, you're going to have to retrofit or bring in aftermarket front-facing cameras or rear-facing cameras in order to get a return on investment. I think one of the things that we're recommending in this pleading is, okay, if you want to deal with the driver shortage, get some of these guys who have got a payment on a piece of equipment, they're going to be left with a truck and no job after AB5 takes over, and figure out a way to help them start their own venture. The problem is a one of capital. One of what can they afford? One thing I want to talk about, probably not tonight, but certainly at NASDIC, is the fact that we don't have a level playing field anymore. We've got these A-class predators in the broker market that think, send him a 20-page contract. He has to have the load. He'll sign it. And the terms and conditions of the contract are totally unconscionable in terms of a risk proposition, because you're signing away that you've got insurance coverage that you don't. You're one accident away from being placed out of business when you sign the contract. So if I sound depressed about saying that, happy days aren't here again, I'm looking at a driver shortage on the one hand, but still not really a fair treatment for the small entrepreneurs that, I think are the backbone of the industry. So that's my story, guys, and I'm sticking to it.
Hank, I agree with you. They are the backbone of the industry. There's no two doubts about it. They're always, unfortunately, and this is how this business is, and Tommy, you can back me up or not, but the small carriers from one to five trucks, they're always one accident away from being put out of business. And that's why we really try to push for the – we do it here, and I do it when I'm talking to carriers – to start getting used to the idea of serving one lane. Don't try to be, again, we talked about it on the show at least 100 times, where don't try to be a 48-state carrier with three trucks. It doesn't work. Pick one lane and know it, because the insurance company is going to be a lot more comfortable with what you're doing. And your drivers get more familiar with it. It just works. But I do need to mention something today, guys, and I want to hear from both of you, both our guests on this. In the last week in the Toronto area, we have had a number of, and some of them weren't really small. Some of them were like 60 truck carriers close up and just close up and go out of business. My understanding is what happened was these companies built a business without understanding insurance. And insurance is the backbone of our industry, of a trucking company. That's your undercarriage. And they were sold, just a little bit of static in the background on my end. Are you guys hearing it down in the U.S. as well? Okay. So it's not just up in Canada. And I think that we need to just talk about for a minute what carriers need to look at to make sure they have insurance. Now, the story I heard from a number of people is we had carriers here that were not sophisticated at all, didn't understand insurance, were really buying what we call a pink slip, which is just the insurance thing you carry in your truck showing the authorities you have insurance, and you can file with the authorities, and you can buy your license tag with it, but not understanding the depth of it. And apparently, these guys unknowingly bought into captives by an unsavory insurance agent. So when you have somebody, and these were all, for the most part, these were carriers owned by fairly recent immigrants, people have come to Canada in the last 20 or 30 years, and I'm sure they work very hard to build their businesses, and they're just, I guess the temptation is the equipment market and the real estate market is so high. Let's just get rid of the trucks because, for our 2018 Reapers, we can sell them for as much as what we paid for in 2018. So, you know what, let's get out now while the going's good. Put them on the auction block. So what should people look out for when they're buying insurance to make sure that it's bona fide good insurance? Tommy, do you want to answer that?
Yes, I'd like to hear a message. I don't know what went down on these companies that they had an insurance problem at some level. We had talked earlier about a captive. In the U.S., the captive has some insurance, and to make a filing with a captive, you have to have an insurance company to make a filing, and those have to be acceptable to the shippers and be rated. Those companies who made a filing have to pay for the claims that happen, even if the captive goes under. Hank knows that too. So it's more of what put them out of business is the contract they signed that made them responsible for even their own claims or something like that, that they didn't have enough funding, not because of claims that were paid on their behalf by the captive. And I totally agree with you. I have warned against captives. In fact, one of the things that we're going to put in a program that the next program will do is alternate funding. Again, we did it 2 years ago about captives. The number one thing, Hank, is that if they can save money going in with a captive, it'll always fail. A captive is not a short-term play. It's a long-term play. The captive becomes the insurance company and a success. A captive cannot operate and cannot have fewer crashes and fewer losses than a standard insurance company. It's just how well they're doing. And if the captive does not require the person going in it to buy that quote equipment that Hank says is outrageous, then they are selecting people in that captive to join with that aren't safe and aren't paying the price to do it. And I totally agree with you. Putting it back onto the insurance agent is a real concern about that part, and I appreciate
that. Well, it was,
yeah. And so, you know, I don't know the circumstances of it, but you bite too much off and you don't have the cash to pay the claims and stuff. It has to be secured, and this is what puts them out of business, not the actual companies going under per se, but them not being able to fund it.
All right, Tommy, let me have a shot at this. First of all, I understand the need for captives because the market is because of the marketplace economies. I think that the real problems that I want to address are the ones that Chuck mentioned, and that is it's not just immigrants that have a hard time with English that cannot determine whether or not they've got coverage. I'm having a conversation tomorrow with one of the largest insurance brokers in the country who bought the bad news to a broker client. Oh, well, that sophisticated contingent cargo policy we sold you didn't answer the $200,000 claim because there was an exclusion in the policy. Not that it was a follow-form contingent policy, but there was an exclusion against theft in the policy. Now, my conversation with this big league insurance broker probably isn't going very well because I'm going to tell him he owed my client some due diligence. And if he was writing a large contingent policy and did not disclose to him that there was an exclusion for an unguarded truck and the poor guy went to take a pee break and the load was stolen, then he's got some skin in the game. I am tired of well-respected, notable insurance people selling policies that they say, oh, this is a wonderful policy. The underwriter has a great reputation in London, but then not bothering to tell him that there's great big holes in it until crap happens, and then he says, oh, well, I don't know what we can do about it. They won't provide a coverage. I guess you're hung with a nearly $200,000 claim. And in the meantime, the underwriter hadn't even adjusted the claim or figured out that there may be defenses. So, you know, I'm very simply going to serve notice that the old idea for the insurance company to say, well, gee, here's the binder. The policy will come in 3 months later, but you're held responsible for reading and understanding it, shouldn't cut water. If it turns out that somebody needs to fly spec the policy or as part of the underwriting, particularly on cargo, to send a very explicit letter to the agent that says, I want you to verify that there are the following coverages, and put down there the dirty dozen of exclusions so that you can nail the agent's hide to the wall, is something that's long overdue. Now,
Chuck,
Tommy, I'm sure you're not going to like that.
No, you and I have agreed cargo's a bust thing. The problem is all these truckers that you just mentioned just started always by a cargo policy for certificate of insurance and don't look at it and don't understand it. I totally agree the agent has responsibility to do exactly what you're saying, explain the problems with it, and explain what's not covered and how they can have coverage. We preach this in everything that I do. So the first thing is tell your people to look for an agent with TRS designations, because those agents have been in front of me for 48 hours and they've been preached this part of it. I'm not saying they're not going to be as bad as some others, but at least they know how to do it and what they need to do. We had 500
Tommy, you know, I'm a great supporter of your educational process and the people that are there. But you know what I'm telling you is, this is a consistent failure in particularly the contingent cargo area. The policies are all if it were products liability, they couldn't even be sold. Ultimately, through whatever association a motor carrier is involved in, he needs to know what that policy says. And I've got a Dilbert cartoon that I'm sharing, and Dilbert's asking this lawyer, can you read this policy and understand it? And the lawyer says, it's too much gibberish, I can't. And Dilbert just throws up his hands and says, well, I guess I'll have to sign it and see what happens. And unfortunately, that's the way it is with cargo. The carrier from the small...
There's one thing, and this is not an excuse to anything you're saying. I'm not even suggesting this, but contingency cargo is all over the board, and it's not that available in the marketplace. And so it's not an easy product to find with all the holes. But that, again, should be explained by the agent exactly where there are holes in it. So we totally agree with that. It's a hard line to cover right now. I don't know many markets that are willing to venture in that.
Yeah, there are, and they're somewhat pricey. But for folks that are on the call, we used to have a federal regulation that said that some insurance carrier had to file a filing like you have for auto liability that said they would pay the legal liability, the CarMax claim, up to a mere $10,000. And nobody had a problem getting insurance companies to sign off. Hank,
it was $5,000 per vehicle, $10,000 per aggregate. But go ahead, I won't argue about that. How far today is $5,000 going? It pays for shortages and overages, but it's not going to pay the claim.
Well, I understand that, Tommy, but the issue is rather than increasing that to $100,000 so that everybody would have the assurance that a cargo claim would be adjusted and we wouldn't have this swamp that we're in now, the federal government did away with it. When they did away with it, there were 28 groups that said, no, it's needed and it ought to be raised. There were two insurance groups that said, can it? And the federal government said, well, we don't need that regulation. Let's just do away with it. The fact of the matter is that the only way it's going to be a level playing field is if everybody is held to the same minimum standard and the insurance companies are are required to stand up and be counted for in terms of legal liability, because the cargo insurance doesn't cover a carrier's legal liability.
Yeah, well, you know what? I don't understand something. How can insurance companies of all services, how can they be getting away with really selling? Really, it sounds like they're selling fraudulent pieces of paper. No different than me telling you that I've got land in Florida. No offense, Tommy, in some swampland down in Florida. That can never in the middle of the Everglades. You know, how can this be? I couldn't do that and start a public company selling Florida swamp land. They'd lock me up. How can these insurance companies do it?
They're not doing it. The policy, it's just like a homeowner's. What's your deductible? What's your limits? Do you have I'm looking at renewal mine. They want to say how much contents you have, and I pick that limit. I pick the wrong limit, then I'm wrong. Then I pay the loss. The insurance company asks you, what are you doing? What are you haul? And they should explain what's not covered. I totally agree that the insurance agent has a responsibility to explain to the insurer what's covered or not covered. Hank and I are totally on the same thing. But the insurance carriers themselves produce a product, and it has various things, just like the deductible. I mean, you know, one thing that drives me crazy about getting off thing is when Liberty Mutual talks about, we'll sell you the insurance you need. Well, what they're talking about is not selling the comp and collision or things like that, because they're limiting coverage. Do they explain what they're taking away when they say those kind of comments? No, they advertise it, but then try to get somebody coming in. But then, and that's the kind of stuff here. You can write a bare-bone policy. You can write a policy that covers everything. There is some uniformity in auto liability, but there's absolutely none in cargo.
Tommy, you're saying you're repeating what Chuck is talking about. The agent has an obligation to explain to the customer, even if he's an agent for the insurance company, what the coverage is. Repeatedly, okay. I see situations in which reputable agents sell policies to flatbed carriers who haul steel, and they don't say that there's an exclusion for wetness, dampness, and moisture. I repeatedly see them that sell to reefer carriers things that says, well, you got reefer breakdown, without explaining that there's also an exclusion for wetness, dampness, and moisture where you can't prove the reefer broke down. And if you get in one of those situations, you and I both know that the underlying insurance company won't even help you adjust the claim. They'll just say, well, show us that the reefer broke down and we'll take a look at it. What does that leave the poor reefer carrier with?
But there are products out there that do not have a spoilage, wetness, and dampness exclusion in it that the agent could or should have offered, but it costs more money and the client doesn't buy it. Now, I'm not saying they would buy it or they would. What I teach is, obviously, after something happens, they'll buy the coverage. I've never seen somebody who says, I would not have bought it if you offered it to me. I don't know the communications you have, and I don't know what agents you're doing with there. We're on the same page about the agent's responsibility to tell the insured the coverage, what is there and what's not there, particularly in the areas of cargo. But also the trucker needs to be disciplined enough and say, here's what I'm hauling, and understand that.
Well, let me suggest this as a take home for anybody who's listening and buying cargo insurance. You know, don't wait until the last minute and have the guy that you play golf with bring you in a quote and a binder. You give to multiple agents a description of what you haul, and you ask in plain English for him to examine the contract and certify that there is coverage for the type of typical loss that we all recognize as a loophole. And then, you know, get him to put it in writing, because otherwise, you know, he's going to say, well, gee, you know, you didn't ask, I didn't tell, gee, I'm so sorry, you know, it's tough. And most small carriers are going to say, oh, well, it's just a loss I've got to write off. And, you know, I guess what I'm saying is that would be malpractice if you were a doctor or a lawyer.
Well, yeah, it would be.
I don't disagree that the agent, that the insurance is going to say, here's what I'm hauling. Am I dropping hook? Am I reefer? Am I hauling, as you said, if it's a flatbed hauling steel or hauling grass? I mean, what am I hauling, and do I have coverage for it? And then what will it cost me for the coverage? I mean, I totally agree with that part of it. The policies are out there in the marketplace that covers this, is most of the time it's a function of cost. And a lot of the particularly small motor carriers aren't willing to pay the cost. And in that sense, Hank, the broker contingency cargo that you just mentioned, is it because the insurance on the truck that hauled the load didn't pay and the broker thought they had coverage? Is that the case that you're talking about here now?
No, I'm talking about a specific policy. I've never seen it. It's not a follow form thing. You and I both know how crooked that is. It basically says, well, if the carrier that hauled the load had an exclusion, then you don't have coverage. So, you know, that isn't like saying that you know, you've got some cement to cover up the holes. That's a notorious exclusion. This particular policy said that regardless of any coverage issue in the underlying carrier, it would not pay on a case in which there wasn't an employee on the truck at the time of the loss.
Yeah, I've heard of that with commodities.
That's actually was the first E&O case I ever had, was that dispute. What's an intended policy mean? It's a provision of the policy. Because in the old days, Carolina Casualty had something called a lot truck warranty, which is actually an intended vehicle warranty. That was the first E&O case I ever had, Hank, just for that example here, to define what is a secured lot, because that's where it comes down to. And was it in a secured lot when the loss happened? And I don't know what they were hauling, and there are some reasonableness depending on the theft potential of the cargo that would have something like that in it. But you're right, that's a problem.
Well, you know, I think to any reasonable man, if you're in this particular industry where you've got some high value goods, and your agent knows what industry you're in, or just knows that you know theft is a problem. Heck, that's obvious, and sells you a contingent policy that has an exclusion if there's nobody on the truck. Then you know I think tell your E&O carrier I'm looking to you to pay the claim.
Hey, we don't disagree with that. Chuck, your concern, let's go back and circle around your concern with two or three companies in Canada. What kind of publicity do you fear that have the insurance as a factor of them shutting down? Are you sure?
It was.
Is that what they're reporting?
The story is, on all of them, they got hit with claims that the insurance company, and in some cases wasn't even an insurance company, it was a captive, threw back on them, and they just thought, you know what, I can't take this loss, I'm done. And there's been a number of them in the last week, which concerns me, because, you know, insurance is something you buy, you hope you never have to use it. Now, granted, they may have had to go to secondary markets because they had a lousy safety rating. So, you know, so be it on them, but still, they were providing a service, they were buying insurance, and then they found out they really didn't have it.
Is this as a result of the cargo loss?
Let me analyze what you said. they what I heard you saying is that they had a plan that they had to pay some of the losses themselves. That's an assumption
right.
of that of part of it to get a reduced premium. And when the claims happened, they weren't willing to pay the insurance company back for what they paid out on their behalf. If that happens,
well,
that's,
I don't think
that's
it
a
was.
Typical Baptist setup.
I really don't believe it was, any of them were cases of high deductibles. These were all insurance claims that they felt that these trucking companies thought they were insured. Turned out they weren't insured. They had to eat the claim themselves, and it wasn't worthwhile, and they just thought, the heck with it. And now I know at least on a couple of them, and I don't know about all, they were sold insurance, but they found out after, and that's how unsophisticated these buyers were. They were sold insurance, but found out it wasn't really insurance. It was a captive. But they were sold it under the guise of it being insurance. And they were so happy to get those pink slips, they accepted it, not realizing what they were getting into. Now, that's a lousy
agent. I'll blame it.
Yeah, that's a horrible agent. I couldn't imagine a worse agent. But nonetheless, this happened. And it concerns me of how somebody could make that mistake, number one. And on the other hand, how somebody could be that devious to sell somebody a policy that's not really a policy. You sold them swampland in Florida.
Well, if they weren't, I blame the agent. If they're not financially sound enough to take care of the obligations they have with the insurance policy on a deductible or retention plan, the agent is wrong. I mean, they should have explained the downside. This is why no small motor carrier is capable of having a deductible beyond 5,000 or 10,000 PD in case you run into somebody at a dock. But and there's a lot of agents out there who think captives is the ultimate solution, which in my opinion is not, unless it's a captive with very strict restrictions requirements to get into it, and it's priced at a predictability based on not hope but based on reality. But anyway, I was just concerned about that. It didn't have to do with cargo though, did it? That was when I was getting back.
I don't know. You know what? In all fairness, I don't know if it had to do with cargo or it had to do with a crash. I have no or whether it was a truck stolen. I can tell you, gentlemen, that I was giving a lot of work to a very good carrier who was part of a very well respected captive here in Southern Ontario, who at one time approached my son and I about joining, and we looked at each other and we just weren't comfortable with it, although we knew several people in it. And this one insurance company had a load of our electronics on board, and it was parked in their yard. And this yard is like Fort Knox. It's well guarded. There's high fences and everything else. And mysteriously, on a Saturday night, our load got stolen. A lock yard with probably 100 trailers, and it was that load of electronics that went missing. And we went to the carrier and we said, listen, we need something for the customer saying that, there's insurance. And the captive was not able to write that. And we had to stop doing business with that carrier because of that, because they could not give us any type of proof from the captive that was going to be covered. So that kind of turns my stomach a little bit about captives to start with, personally. But that's my personal opinion. I know other people listening here probably belong to them and have been very, had a great time with them and done very well.
Well,
but
I tell you this, captives, I share Tommy's concern with the structure and all of that. But at the end of the day, captives are the way that my middle-sized to larger carriers are are dealing with the insurance crisis. And, you know, when I speak to little trade groups I survey, you know, what needs to be done about trying to get some kind of settlement for the crises the small members are paying. The large guy says, oh, I'm just very happy in my captive, and, you know, I'm off with the national indemnity, or people who have some experience in working in those things. And, you know, I was talking to a guy today about the independent contractor crises, and, you know, he was confirming that his insurance rate through he's not in a captive, but in the traditional market with 100 trucks are 25% what a new guy would pay. And, you know, that's just the cost of being new and the cost of the restricted market. So somehow to right this ship, we've got to find a way for drivers with good records to get a reasonable insurance payment. You know, a lot of the bus companies and folks like that, you know, jump into an insurance pool in certain states. I don't know whether there needs to be pool coverage available at some moderated rate for everybody who passes a new carrier audit or something like that. But obviously what we've got is not working very well.
Hey, well, pools, tell me something. How do pools – I've never heard this term. We don't have it up in Canada. Can we talk for a moment? And can you, Edgy, maybe Rico, I don't know if you know about pools. You know, the only pools I know are the ones you swim in. So could you
I'll give you a short – let me give you a short 101. Because insurance is required by law in states, the state has to have a mechanism – to provide insurance no matter how bad you are. Those are the state insurance pools. The retention plans, they are the last resort, whatever you call it. Theoretically, and there's some exception. Right now, Illinois is exception. So is North Carolina. The insurance markets who write that line of business, if the pool does not make money, has to share that. There's restrictions. Like in Florida, the pool has to be 25% higher than it is with the standard market. So a last resort pool is not the answer, except a few rare states who are not policing it to that level. But that's why it's there, Chuck. It's because insurance is required by government. The government can't require something without having a mechanism so that everybody can buy it. That's the theory.
Okay. Where I learned about pools is in representing bus companies. You saw all the poor bastards that were trying to serve in Florida, and the pool was exorbitant, all of a sudden having addresses in North Carolina. Of course,
that's not
kosher, but that when you got to have $5 million worth of liability insurance, it becomes a huge big stick, particularly if your state has got prohibitive expenses and all you're doing is taking people from the airport to Disneyland.
Right. Well, gentlemen, I'm looking close. We're getting a little tight on time. I want to get one question out there. Maybe Tommy, you can set this one up for you. With carriers, small guys such as myself, coming up on renewal, what would be your suggestion on how they need to pursue that whole thing? Do they go back and of course dealing with their current agent or whatever, but should they be out shopping around, and what's the best way to shop to get the best rate?
I know who you're with, and they represent a number of markets that are good markets, and ask them to shop it around. And my opinion is that you want to stay with the insurance company that you've been with, that you've got a history with, whenever possible, as long as the price is there. And if the price is what the market is, and you haven't had any bad reactions, you should expect it close to a level of renewal. maybe a slightly discounted renewal in some places, Rocco. You know, I know a couple companies looking at 1 or 2% for a good history, trucking company with history. That's the key. The key that Hank just said, the problem is with no history, that's where the insurance companies have the worst problem. That's where they're using this these electronic stuff that we talked about. It doesn't cost that much. Do you have ELDs, right? Do you have an app that reads or prints out your ELDs with the drivers and stuff, Rocco?
Yes. Rico,
it doesn't print. It doesn't. I don't have the ability to print out on the spot. I can email.
There's apps in the marketplace for like $180 a year per vehicle that will give you a record about where you're going and hard brakes and ELDs and miles. That's going to be the solution, and you show that to the insurance carrier. Here's my record, and I'll give you access to that. They're going to give you better rates. It's just that simple. The more information you're willing to share, the better the rates will be, because now they know they're more comfortable with what's happening. And that's where it's going to go. If you give me a call tomorrow, I'll tell you what that app is.
Hey, Tommy, what do you think? What do you think, Tommy? What do you think an underwriter's response would be if a new carrier or somebody been in business for 6 months walked in and said, "Look, you know, the silly FMCSA audited me, but they wouldn't give me a satisfactory safety rating, so I went out here and hired somebody equivalent to what they have in the bus industry, a trained auditor." And he did FMCSA class audit.
No insurance company looks adverse to anybody without a safety rating, period. No insurance company today considers non-rated a problem. Nobody. They consider additional some problem and unsatisfactory, but not non-rated, period.
Well, yeah, but here's the issue. Here's the issue with that. You may say that, but part of the problem
they don't. I talk to them. Nobody pays attention to that.
I'm not disagreeing with what I'm saying is the access that a newbie has as a non-rated carrier is directly affected by the plaintiff's bar's attitude and the opportunity for a nuclear judgment. It makes a whole hell of a lot of difference if you get into a plaintiff's bar lawsuit.
Hank, if you read the nuclear verdicts, none of them had anything to do with the safety fitness determination. It has to do with the CSA score. That's what's coming back and haunting them. Nobody has bought I've read the cases. None of the cases have been involved with an unrated insurance carrier. I mean, a motor carrier.
I'm not talking about an unrated insurance carrier.
No, non-insured, a motor carrier. Where the satisfactory, their rating is unrated. Nobody. That's 90% of the marketplace, Chuck. 90% of motor carriers don't have a rating.
Right. That's true.
I understand that, Tommy. I'm not naive about that.
Nobody pays attention to that in this marketplace because they understand they don't have a rating. That's never brought up in any nuclear verdicts, and it's never been brought up in any underwriting that I'm aware of. But every underwriter that I know in this marketplace understands what I just told you. Tommy,
respectfully, my friend, it becomes an up supply chain liability issue when plaintiff's bar gets into it and they say, Mr. Shipper, Mr. Broker, you used an unrated carrier. He didn't have a satisfactory safety rating. So what criteria did you use? And then we open the bar to the whole discussion of SMS methodology, the ability to send one of those lawsuits if you have a witness who can testify that you're in compliance with FMCSA regulation. Takes the fangs out of the plaintiff's bar.
I have read these nuclear verdicts. That's never been brought up. because you've got 11% of motor carriers that rated satisfactory.
Well, Tommy, I'll send you some cases, and I'll tell you this, that the real concern that I think results in a whole lot of insurance companies throwing in $1 million very quickly is the fact that the guy is unrated, and the plaintiff's bar has hired one of the scam owners.
Hank, you're absolutely wrong. Call to your friends Rob and Clay and those people. It's never brought up.
Well, I sure have been in three or four that they have been.
Well, gentlemen, we're gonna have to. We're going.
I've certainly been involved in the lawsuits.
We're gonna have to come back and maybe readdress this one at another time. We are running right up against that wall. But I want everyone to know that if you want to get in contact with Hank Seaton, we need his help, his services. You can contact him over at transportationlaw.net. And Tommy, if you want to get a hold of Tommy and his organization, as Tommy always says, he ain't trying to sell you anything. But Tommy, what's your website again?
MCIEF, Motor Carriers Insurance Education, MCIEF.org. And if you've got any questions while Hank and I just went through, please send me an email and I'll look at it and I'll answer these things for you.
Well, once again, gentlemen, we definitely appreciate you guys. We enjoy the banter.
Thank you so
and
much.
In the back and forth, the spirited debate. We really do love it and appreciate it. Like I say, I definitely learn something every time that you guys come on. And so with that being said, I want to thank you guys again for taking time out of your schedule to do so. Chuck, let the folks know how they can get a hold of you, and we'll find a way to back this thing into a hole until next week.
Okay, Rico. Get a hold of me via email, just chuck@traffix.com, or you can give me a call. My extension is 203. Phone number is 1-800-388-4352. If you need to get set up with Traffix or I can help you in any way at all with your business, reach out, please. It's my honor. And with that, Rico, I'm going to let you back into the hole till next week.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, this has been the Racing Lanes Podcast. We appreciate you guys for taking time out to hang out with us. You could have been anywhere else in the world,
yeah,
but you took a little
here.
Time to hang with us. We're always eternally grateful for that. So with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, I want you guys to stay safe out there, stay healthy, and we'll talk at the same time, same place next week. Keep it in between the mustard and the mayonnaise. God bless you and good night.
Catch you on the flip-flop. God bless.